You're listening to Law and Justice on UCC 98.3 FM. I'm Jane Mulcahy, and this is our fifth episode. We have, as usual, a fairly jam-packed programme for you today, starting with Lauren Siri, who's in studio with me, a chap from the US with a very exciting history working in the criminal justice field, and he's going to tell us a bit about that and what brings him to Ireland. Then we will have a piece with Owen McIntyre, who is on the staff of UCC and an expert in environmental law. And we also have a segment from the Law Society Conference on the Sexual Offences Act of 2017 with Nolene Blackwell and Tom O'Malley, who were some speakers there at the conference. So we'll go straight into the interview with Lawrence. Lawrence, thank you very much for joining me today. How are you?
Pretty good, thank
you. He's nodding anyway. So, Lawrence, you are from the States. Can you tell us a little bit about your past, I suppose, and yes, your exciting exploits?
So I was a public defender in New York for many years. I grew up in Florida to Irish parents.
Okay.
My mother's from Mayo. And I became a lawyer and worked on a number of cases that were very interesting, but after about 3 or 4 years became a public defender, which is the way the United States funds indigent criminal work.
Okay.
So I worked for a public defender's office in a rural community in upstate New York near the Vermont border, the Massachusetts-Vermont border, and that's a very poor area, but a rural poor area.
Okay.
And then I moved from there after 9/11. I took a job in the Bronx, working with the Legal Aid Society as a supervisor in their juvenile justice wing. So anybody who was under the age of 16 who was arrested for minor or major crimes would come through my office, and we had a team of lawyers that represented them. The cases involved, it could be simple fights, you know, perhaps marijuana use, or it could go all the way up to murder and child prostitution. So they were very interesting cases. Very difficult work with very dedicated lawyers who did an amazing job with their representation. But after a few years of that, I found that I kind of needed to have an emotional break
yeah,
from that. So, well, not an emotional break.
I know what you mean, yeah.
So I ended up taking a transfer within the Legal Aid Society to their Manhattan office, where I represented adults in all sorts of crimes, which is very exciting. And it sounds weird, but it's a fantastic job to have. Very difficult work, but
intellectually stimulating, I'd imagine.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you're on your feet in the courtroom 5 or 6 days a week, sometimes until 1 in the morning.
Mm.
The caseloads are insane.
Okay.
But the level of practice, I have to say, it's the same organization that I was with in the Bronx, but the level of practice is extraordinary. So they have probably about 120, 130 lawyers in the Manhattan office, and they have offices in all 5 boroughs doing criminal work only. There's another office that does housing work and another that does immigration, but they're kind of the backbone of indigent advocacy in New York. And they've been around for about 150 years.
Okay.
So the level of practice was very high, and it gave me the opportunity to do a murder trial. And it's all jury work, so it's you know, it's sort of
the stakes are very high.
Very high.
I mean, they're always high in any country, but does New York have the death penalty?
No.
Okay.
They abolished it a number of years ago, but they, at the time that I was there, they did have the 3 strikes rule.
So okay.
You had, in fact, I had a few cases where there would be a 23, 24-year-old who was looking at 25 years to life if convicted. But the juries are, they're difficult in New York, but in comparison to upstate New York, where I had been practicing, they are much, much more reasonable.
Well, they're probably way more ethnically diverse in New York.
You would hope so.
Yeah, as compared with rural.
There's a lot of leeway room as far as picking the jury. So
okay.
The prosecution and the defense, unlike perhaps in the UK, the defense lawyer and the prosecutor have a lot more input into who gets sat on the jury. So
the peremptory strike.
As well as strikes for cause.
Okay.
So a lot of work, a lot of training goes into how to pick a jury.
Okay.
And what kind of sociological things you're looking at with an eye towards, especially as a defense lawyer, you know, race and class have play a big role in that. Yeah. You're trying to get a jury of your client's peers who are going to fairly judge the case.
Yes.
You're fighting the whole system at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and at that time period, it was one of the, it was before a lot of the body cams and stuff like that. And there was a lot of reports of some of the incidents that have now come to light through people's cell phones mm-hmm. or mobile phones. That we had to deal with on an everyday basis.
You mean African-American men and people of color being assaulted or dealt with harshly?
In a way that only seems unreal.
Okay.
You know, and we had no proof of it before the...
Sure, the advent, mobile. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was an amazing place to work. It was... every day was an adventure. Some days you... wish the adventure would end,
yeah.
But for the most part, it was very rewarding and it was very inspiring because you got to work with people that are, you know, like giants in the legal field. And I go back once a year, and I usually spend a week in New York, and I go and I talk to them and find out their latest cases because sometimes I use them in my last job in Luxembourg. I would use them when I was teaching criminal law. The problems and the issues, and then you can...
To make it real for students, absolutely. I suppose, yeah.
Absolutely, and you can kind of understand what it means to be a person of color in New York City, which is one of the more open cities in the United States, but what it means to be a child or a young adult or an older adult in the criminal justice system in the United States.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. When you were talking there about jury selection, I was wondering whether now people's tweets and kind of social media behavior might be taken into account in deciding whether they're likely to...
Well, yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was a number of years ago that I was there. So 2009 was the last time I was actually practicing in New York. But even at that point... There was one jury selection where one of our attorneys noticed somebody was on their mobile phone during the break and pulled up her, I don't know if it was a Facebook feed or I don't know if Twitter was around at that point, but picked up on the feed in order to show the judge that that person was biased against black people.
Right, okay.
And so it was very effectively used. A fantastic lawyer. He, you know, knew what was out there and honed in on it enough to bring it to the judge's attention, say this person can't sit on the jury because she's already made up her mind as the guilty.
And I suppose it might also have an impact though, people's consumption of media through Twitter, you know, in terms of keeping an open mind in relation to the case.
Well, I mean, if you talk about the general political system in the United States right now, we have a particular politician who's at the helm.
Who could you mean?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But when I first arrived in New York as a young law student, there was a case on in New York, and it was the Central Park jogger case, which was a big case in New York. It was five or six young African-American men who were arrested for the brutal rape of a jogger through Central Park, and she had no memory of the incident.
Okay.
The police arrested these young people who had been quote unquote wilding in the park, and that's where that term comes from.
Okay.
Wilding comes from this case. And each of them eventually gave a confession. And this real estate developer actually asked for their execution in Central Park in a full page ad in the New York Times.
Right.
It turns out after they spent would say almost 20 years in jail, maybe more, that they were all exonerated through DNA evidence, and the confessions were false. So this rush to judgment at that time, the United States does not have the protections of defendants at that time period in the arrest.
Yeah.
Their names are out there, their images are out there, unless they're a juvenile.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to get on a big case like that, to get a fair trial because everybody knows about it. And in New York is a big town, but it's also a small town when it comes to crime and...
Certainly violent crime and sexual crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then you were in Luxembourg for a period of time working as an academic and teaching criminal law, and now you're here. What are you doing here, Lawrence?
What am I doing here? I do a lot of the skills modules.
Okay.
I do the legal writing and the third year moot.
Okay.
And I am directing the Law and French program.
Okay.
So it's a little diverse.
It's very diverse.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Big change from the cut and thrust of the courtroom.
Well, yeah. In some ways.
Yeah.
I think every job has its challenges, but it's very rewarding here. I love Cork. And it's I like what I do. So, you know, I like the teaching advocacy or teaching new students how to get on with their studies.
Yeah.
So, and the Law and French, I adore those students. I think they're fantastic, mm-hmm. very bright. And I think that program is particularly fantastic for, it's an opportunity for students who can progress into to jobs in the EU as
sure.
well as in firms. I think it is an unbelievable asset to not only our university, but to the greater academic community. So.
And as someone who grew up in America and has been through that educational system, how do you find our system of, youthful people coming directly from school into a law degree? Is there a difference there in their maturity or their ability? For example, do you think there are merits to doing a more general undergrad and then going into the lawyering craft?
Well, I think that there's positives and negatives on both sides. I think the students that come out of Cork that I've seen are incredibly prepared,
okay.
incredibly well able to take on their careers. I don't have that experience as an academic looking down in the American system.
Okay.
Only as...
Been through it yourself,
having been
yeah.
through it, I was, perhaps a little lost when I was 22 years old. I think I would be the last one to want to change the foundations of the Irish.
Okay, very diplomatic. Yeah. That could be a future
fine.
Career. Yeah, yeah.
Fine.
Well, it's just that they're younger, having
yes.
to make that decision to commit to, well, and of course they can change their minds, but
right.
laws for me at 18 when...
Right.
You know.
Well, but that has its benefits as well.
Okay.
So, you know.
Okay. And so you're here for, is it 2 years, Lawrence?
I'm here for 2 years.
Okay.
Yes.
And you're enjoying it so far.
I love Cork.
Okay.
And I love the university. It's a great place. I could not be happier.
And have you been to Mayo yet to check out?
Every other weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or to Galway. My son is studying law in NUI Galway, so I make up to see my family up there, and that's
okay.
That's very nice.
Well, that's yeah. great. Thank you so much for coming in, and it was great chatting with you. And enjoy your stint here at UCC
yes.
in the law school. Thanks so much, Lawrence. We'll take a track, Alan, please.
Stop. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy. It's the 14th of November, and next up we have a segment with Owen McIntyre on the future of water.
How are you, Owen?
Very well.
I recently cited an article published in the Times revolving on water, around water, the future of water and law. Owen, in your opinion, are water wars more likely in the future?
Personally, I think they probably aren't. Journalists tend to love to talk about water wars, and it's a phrase that comes up again and again. But it's not actually borne out by experience. As water resources globally become scarcer, one would expect that there would be greater competition for those resources, and that competition might give rise to conflict between states. But experience suggests that that is not what's happening, that in fact states are learning to cooperate over water resources in a way that makes actual conflict over shared waters less likely.
And how might these conflicts be avoided going forward?
Well, the body of rules that we would now refer to as international water law has developed a quite sophisticated suite of procedural requirements or procedural rules, which essentially facilitate interstate communication over shared water resources. So where problems arise, where an upstream state is polluting water, which is having an adverse effect on downstream states, or where one or more states on an international basin are over-abstracting water. There are a range of quite sophisticated ways for states to communicate amongst themselves, to express their displeasure, to communicate over what they see to be or perceive to be threats to their water security. These issues mostly arise where one state is planning a new project. And really increasingly sophisticated requirements have emerged in legal frameworks for the prior notification and consultation with affected states over such new projects or planned measures.
And to what extent do people depend on shared water resources?
Well, very, very much, actually. At least, probably slightly more than 60% of the world's population rely on what we would refer to as transboundary water resources. These would be shared international rivers, lakes, and groundwater sources, aquifers. Groundwater sources are particularly important in terms of human use of water. Of those, several hundred, almost 300 shared basins. Two-thirds lack any formal cooperative management framework based on international treaties or conventions. So there really is a great need for the further development of international cooperative frameworks by means of international treaties for, you know, a number, particularly major shared basins that are heavily used.
And are more sophisticated responses to water scarcity emerging?
Well, they are. Slowly, but but they certainly are. And this is a response, really, perhaps, to greater water scarcity. I mean, we have a problem of water scarcity where it's estimated, for example, by the UNDP that by 2030, global water requirements, the amount of water actually used, will be double what it was in 2005. So in 25 years, we're seeing a doubling of water consumption. Now, using that much water by 2030, that will mean that water demand globally will exceed current reliable supply levels by around 40%. So a great many basins and societies will be suffering water stress. There will not be enough water to go around. So this has been described as the great environmental crisis of the 21st century. Of course, we think of climate change as the great crisis of the 21st century, and I'm not trying to downgrade the problems presented by climate change. But if climate mitigation is about gas, or gases, climate adaptation is about water. So this is very closely linked to the need to adapt to climate change. We have rapidly, massively growing consumption at the same time as climate variability is likely to impact on the availability of water. So sophisticated responses are emerging at a number of levels. I just mentioned cooperative requirements in law, communication requirements, so that what we refer to often as procedural requirements, where states must communicate and they must share information on planned projects, on the state of basins, on current levels of use of water, of future planned uses of water. So these prior notification and consultation requirements are now really universal, where we have cooperative frameworks, and even where we don't, the background rules we refer to as customary international law would require that these cooperative, communicative steps are gone through. But probably more fundamentally, our understanding of water systems has changed, and it's changed really in the last 15 or 20 years, has changed very fundamentally. So rather than see a river from which it's possible to abstract a certain amount of water, or into which it's possible to dump a certain amount of pollutants, we see the emergence of what we refer to as an ecosystem approach. That basin is seen as a functioning ecosystem. And that changes everything in many ways. From the legal perspective, that requires, increasingly clear that that requires that we exercise precaution in terms of decisions around uses that should be permitted, that we maintain and guarantee flows. So we seek to understand what are minimum environmental flows, what amount of water do we need, is the minimum amount needed to ensure that the ecosystem continues to function, that species continue to survive and wetlands continue to function. That requires often adaptive management so that we change the rules as we understand more how uses are impacting on the functioning of an ecosystem. Of course, ecosystem dynamics are very, very, very complex, and so we won't necessarily be able to foresee every impact in advance of permitting an activity. And all in all, you know, we see the water course as an ecosystem, and we value it, if you like, in terms of the ecosystem services that it can provide. Now, that's just changing the language. We always understood that water systems, river systems, drainage systems, could give us drinking water, could be used in food production, could be used for the production of energy, and of course are vital in mining and industry and various other purely economic uses. But to think of these as ecosystem services means we also have to value the non-economic uses or services, or the non-marketable services. So things like flood attenuation, the interseasonal storage of water, where wetlands and other features of a functioning drainage basin ecosystem provide these for us. We don't need to provide hard infrastructure when there is soft natural infrastructure in place. All we have to do is protect it. Providing fisheries, but many, many other services, you know, cultural and amenity-related services, from the obvious, from recreational uses often to the religious significance of river basins. So we are moving in a direction which is, but slowly, in a direction which allows us to take a very much more sophisticated understanding of the value of drainage basin systems. And hopefully that will result in greater protection of those values, greater maintenance of these various ecosystem services provided.
Does international water law support more efficient management of international water distribution?
I think it does, but it does so in a number of ways. Often when one talks to an economist will tell you that, you know, certain uses of water by one state or another state, if we're talking about a shared river, for example, that certain uses by one state produce or add a great deal more value in dollar terms than uses by another state. But in international law, we don't place too much value on that, because that would be to give automatic advantage to more developed states, states that are more technologically developed, that have more resources to utilize drip irrigation technology, etc., to the disadvantage of those states that can't at the moment afford to do so. That would be to lock in disadvantage, and there would be problems of equity in such an approach. So international law has never sought to support the most efficient use of water. Of course, it would generally tend to disincentivize willful or negligent waste or wasteful use of water. But I think where international law can make the greatest contribution is by supporting the idea of optimal use, that what we really require is the most benefit, the greatest benefit to be derived from the use of shared water resources. Now, very often, that means including all of the social, cultural, and other benefits that a broad ecosystem services approach allows us to take account of. So, you know, in a less developed state, perhaps their use of water in irrigation for food security is not as efficient in another state. But it probably does create food security. It probably does create a great number of jobs in less sophisticated economies where the options are only really to work in agricultural production. So international law tries to take a broader distributive equity approach. So to try and ensure that the greatest distribution of benefits from the use of these shared waters is achieved. Of course, that's quite complex, quite sophisticated, and for that reason, the core rules of international water law are somewhat vague, where they're described as being normatively indeterminate. They seek to achieve equitable arrangements, equitable apportionments, fair apportionment of benefit from the use of waters, having regard to, you know, all the various uses, the various state entities that have a share in those waters, their ability to benefit, and the ways in which they can benefit best.
Thank you very much, Owen, for speaking to us on Law and Justice Podcast.
So that was Professor Owen McIntyre with Alan Drum, the producer of Law and Justice. You're listening to Law and Justice on UCC 98.3 FM. We're going to have a track now, specially chosen by Luke, who's on work experience, and it's Brother by Codaline. Thanks very much for a great choice, Luke.
The kings and queens, oh yeah, we rule the world. We smoke cigarettes, man, no regrets. Wish I could relive every single word. We've taken different paths and traveled different roads. I know we'll always end up on the same one when we're old. And when you're in the trenches and you're under fire, I will cover you. If I I've got you, brother. I've got you, brother. Oh, brother, we can go deeper than the ink beneath the skin of our tattoos. No, we don't share the same blood. You're my brother and I love you, that's the truth. We're living different lives, heaven only knows. If we make it back, we'd all 5 years, 20 years, come back, we'll always be the same. If I was dying on my knees, you would be the one to rescue me. And if you were drowned at sea, I'd give you my lungs so you could breathe. I've got you, brother. I've got you, brother. And if we hit on
been saved, and we'll be carrying each other until we say goodbye on our dying day. Because I've got you, brother. I've got you, brother. I've got you, brother. I've got you, brother. If I
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy. That was Brother by Codaline, chosen by Lucas on Work Experience. Our final piece is from the Law Society Conference on the Sexual Offences Act 2017, where I spoke to Nolene Blackwell, who's the Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and with Tom O'Malley, who's an expert in sentencing. So hopefully you'll enjoy that piece now.
My name is Nolene Blackwell. I'm the CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre.
And Nolene, you gave the opening address here at the UCC Law Society Conference on the Sexual Offences Act 2017. Can you tell me some of the key points in this legislation that were of value to the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre?
Yeah, so what I was looking at here today was how it fits into a broader debate that's happening in society anyway around the treatment of sexual offences. And one of the things that was really important to us in the legislation was that consent was clearly defined. While it was there in law, in judgments, it wasn't anywhere in the legislation. So it wasn't, you couldn't read it in black and white, which was really a difficulty in a crime which is very hidden. So it was set out in black and white that consent was free and voluntary in all cases, and if it wasn't, then a sexual offence was being committed if sexual activity took place. So then I spoke a little bit about the various things that legislation says about where consent will not take place, and concentrated really on the issue of where people are affected by alcohol or other drugs, and just tease that out a little bit because it's still an area of contention in society. How someone is not capable of giving their full consent if they're incapacitated by alcohol or other drugs. So I spoke a little bit about that and about how actually there is an attitudinal change, but there needs to be, because people are at risk in some way of committing rape without even properly knowing it, thinking that rape is only about forcing someone to have sex, instead of recognising that sexual assault up to and including rape happens where there's coercion, pressure, and people are intimidated into sexual activity. And the other thing that I then spoke a little bit about was the need to ensure that all of the provisions of the legislation are properly implemented. There's some very big provision there for protection of vulnerable people, offences relating to children being approached on the internet, and child pornography, offences against people with intellectual disabilities, but which also recognises their right to a family life, offences against people who are exploited through living in prostitution, and vulnerable witnesses. And all of those are positive and will tend towards a better, more civilised society if properly implemented. But my question, or I suppose my hope, was that we would see full implementation. Most of them are law already, but for instance, the provisions relating to special arrangements for witnesses in court, which might prevent somebody cross-examining them personally, that's still not implemented. And we think that if it is that, and special protection for children, special protection for counselling notes, these are the kind of things that will make the victims place in the court system a little bit easier than it is at present.
And Olaine, are you heartened by the fact that the UCC Law Society chose this topic this year for its annual conference?
I think it's absolutely marvellous that the Law Society chose the topic of the new Act this year. It ties in, of course, with other work that I'm also very pleased to see the Society doing with the students around better understanding of consent and what sexual violence is. So it is just, in some ways, it horrifies me that people would not have this kind of a conference, would not know what the law is, would not understand where they are the victims of a crime simply because they don't recognise what happened to them as sexual violence. That's desperate to think a person could be in that situation. And it's also horrific that somebody wouldn't understand that their behaviour was criminal when they could know it. So in highlighting the new Act, in highlighting that it is a whole discussion on around what sexual violence is like in our world today, I think UCC Law Society have done a real service to the college and to the wider community, and also they organised it brilliantly.
Tom O'Malley, Senior Lecturer in Law at NUI Galway and Barrister, and I'm also a member of the Law Reform Commission.
Tom, you gave a great talk there, talking us through some of the main provisions of the Sexual Offences Act 2017, but you also called for a wider codification of sexual offences. Why do you think that's important?
Well, because this Act of 2017 is very important. It deals with a lot of specific provisions, but is by no means a comprehensive statute insofar as sex offences are concerned. When you look at the entirety of the statute law governing sex offences, it ranges from acts passed in 1885 right down to the present day. So if you're dealing in this area, you're dealing with about at least a dozen statutes, as I say, extending over a period of 130 years or 140 years. And the time has come, especially in such an important area as this, for the government to undertake an exercise where it would codify all of the law on sex offences. In other words, that there be a single statute that would have the entire law in relation to all the different offences of a sexual nature that may be committed. That could include, let's say, child pornography offences. And also the main procedural laws are rules governing sex offences.
And is there a need to streamline definitions still, or has this new Act clarified many of the problematic areas that there were in recent times?
Well, the new Act does a lot of very, very good things. For example, it fills a lot of gaps that existed in the law in relation to child sex abuse offences. Various forms of abuse or exploitation that weren't really criminal before this have now been covered. But the Act doesn't really deal with the definitions of the, if you like, what you might call the foundational sex offences of rape, sexual assault, aggravated sexual assault, and so forth. And probably in relation to rape in particular, of which we actually have two separate offences known to Irish law, one of the things that a codification exercise might do would be, or what it would do, in fact, would be to provide an opportunity to look at anew, if you like, at what the definition of rape should be.
Would it be your view, or is it the case in other countries, that the kind of traditional view of rape that was vaginal penetration with the risk of pregnancy, that is now archaic almost, or redundant, or is there still a place?
Well, yes, I think you're right about that. It is. I mean, that is certainly still a very important form of rape, if you like. But in fact, nowadays, the tendency in other countries has been to make it a gender-neutral offence in many cases, and where the emphasis is on the harm caused by sexual penetration rather than the fact that it's heterosexual intercourse that may lead to pregnancy. So it's very much about, if you like, treating it as, if you like, an offence of violence rather than, if you like, a purely sexual offence.
You mentioned the SAVI report and the need for a new public attitude survey in relation to sexual violence, Nolene. Is that imminent, do you think?
So there has been a lot of calls over a long number of years for a second SAVI report. And all the time, there has been indications that it was, that in the pipeline, exactly. But we have never really got a firm commitment. I am heartened by the commitment made by Minister Zappone when she said she would very much support and will support some sort of a survey or a scoping exercise exercise to identify what a second savvy should contain. We do need it, but obviously it's not going to be like savvy one. So much time has changed. And there's a technological explosion. The number of different communities in the country has changed. Same-sex relationships have become more the norm. People are accessing the internet much younger. So there's a whole set of reasons why it won't work, including the fact that the last one was done by phoning people on their landlines, and very few people have landlines anymore. So that scoping exercise is a really good first step. The minister recommended that CUSC, which is part of the Department of Justice and Equality, should do it. And certainly we in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre will be trying to pull together the people who may be interested in feeding into what a new savvy should look like, and just presenting that information to CUSC to get... Even if we had the scoping exercise done, we would be seeing where the gaps are in our knowledge. We don't have the knowledge we need to properly address sexual violence in Ireland, neither us in the voluntary sector nor the government. And it would be great if we knew what was needed. And I'm also then heartened by Minister Coveney saying as well last week that if it was needed, the money would be found for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a kind of hot topic, I suppose, with all the recent scandals. One final question, Nolene, in terms of actually trying to change attitudes in infancy and in early, you know, growth in girls and boys, how can we do that? Is it the role of parents? Is it the role of schools? Because some of the rape culture is deeply entrenched. Where do we even begin with this?
Yeah, parents are the primary educators of their children. But it's a hard topic to talk about as parents. We all know parents do find it difficult to talk about these things. That's why there are places in schools dealing with physical and sexual and emotional health. They do not adequately address the whole question of respect for oneself in the context of sexual relationships. And that's what it's about. We have seen the most extraordinary programs developed on a voluntary basis by schools. Some schools are fabulous at identifying what consent looks like, and therefore they are making their students and their communities safer by knowing how to say yes and how to say no. The work that UCC is doing at college level is great as well, but in some ways coming into college, not having the basic background of knowing it really is very late and it could be horrifying for someone at that stage. You build up understanding of respect for a person, for one's own person, in your early years. You build up a capacity to be able to say yes politely and no politely, and to hear yes politely and no politely as well. These are things that you start at a very early age. Of course you're not talking about sex to 5 years old, but you are talking about respect for themselves. And what we would love to see is a program stitched through from the earliest years where children can absolutely understand how they are entitled to stay safe. They are entitled not to be violated, and they're obliged not to violate the respect of others as well. It can be done. It is being done elsewhere, and we need it here in Ireland.
You're listening to Law and Justice. I'm Jane Mulcahy. We're going to leave you now with a track, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time on the 28th of November with our next show. So thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks to Lawrence, Owen McIntyre and Nolene Blackwell and Tom O'Malley for contributing to today's show, and to Luke for choosing Brother by Coastline. Bye now.